Side 6, Time's Eye, by Arthur C. Clarke and Stephen Baxter. Continuing on page 224. The procession followed. Even to reach the gate, they had to walk up a ramp to a platform perhaps 15 meters above ground level. As Bessessa walked through it, the gate itself towered 20 meters or more above her head. Every square centimeter of its walls was covered in glazed brickwork, a haunting royal blue surface across which dragons and bulls danced. Ruddy walked with his head tilted back, his mouth gaping open. Still a little seedy from his illness, he walked uncertainly, and Josh kindly took his arm to lead him. "Can this be the Ishtar Gate? Who would have thought? Who would have thought?" The city was laid out in a rough rectangle, its plan spanning the Euphrates. Alexander's party had entered from the north, on the east side of the river. Inside the gate, the procession moved down a broad avenue that ran south, passing magnificent, baffling buildings, perhaps temples and palaces. Bessessa glimpsed statues, fountains, and every wall surface was decorated with dazzling glazed bricks and molded with lions and rosettes. There was so much opulence and detail she couldn't take it all in. The phone, peeking out of her pocket, tried to help. "The complex to your right is probably the palace of Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon's greatest ruler, who..." "Shut up, phone." Casey was hobbling along. "If this is Babylon, where are the hanging gardens?"
"In Nineveh," said the phone dryly.
"No people," said Josh uncertainly. "I see some damage. Signs of fires, looting, perhaps even earthquake destruction. But still, no people. It's getting eerie." "Yeah," growled Casey. "All the lights on, but nobody at home." "Have you noticed," said Abdelkader quietly, "that the Macedonians seem overwhelmed too? And yet they were here so recently." It was true. Even wily Eumenes peered around at the city's immense buildings with awe. "It's possible this isn't their Babylon either," said Bessessa. The party began to break up. Alexander and Hephaestion, with most of the guard, made for the royal palace, back toward the gate. Other parties of troops were instructed to spread out through the city and search for inhabitants. The officers' cries rang out peremptorily, echoing from the glazed walls of the temples. De Morgan said they were warning their men of the consequences of looting.
"But I can't imagine anybody will dare touch a thing in this haunted place."
Bessessa and the others continued on down the processional way, accompanied by Eumenes and a handful of his advisers and guards. The way led them through a series of walled plazas and brought them at last to the pyramid-like structure that Bessessa had glimpsed from outside the city. It was actually a ziggurat, a stepped tower of seven terraces rising from a base that must have been 100 meters on a side. To Bessessa's eyes, conditioned by images of Egyptian pyramids, it looked like something she might have expected to find looming above a lost Mayan city. South of the ziggurat was a temple that the phone said must be the Esagila, the temple of Marduk, the national god of Babylonia. The phone said, "The Babylonians called this ziggurat the Etemenanki, which meant the house that is the foundation of heaven and earth. It was Nebuchadnezzar who brought the Jews here as slave labor. By bad-mouthing Babylon in the Bible, the Jews took a long revenge." Josh grabbed Bessessa's hand. "Come on, I want to climb that blooming heap."
"Why?" "Because it's the Tower of Babel. Look, there's a staircase on the south side."
He was right. It must have been 10 paces wide. "Race you." And, dragging her hand, he was off. She was intrinsically fitter than he was. She had trained as a soldier, and had come from a century far better provided for with food and health care. But he was younger and had been hardened by the relentless marching. It was a fair race, and they kept holding hands until, after 100 steps or so, they took a break and collapsed on the steps. From up here, the Euphrates was a broad silver ribbon, bright even in the ashen light, that cut through the heart of the city. She couldn't make out clearly the western side of the city, but on this eastern side, grand buildings clustered closely. Temples, palaces, presumably government departments. The city plan was very orderly. The main roads were all straight, all met at right angles, and all began and ended in one of the many gates in the walls. The palaces were riots of color, every surface covered with polychrome tiles on which dragons and other fantastic creatures gambled. She asked, "Where are we in time?" Her phone said, "If this is the age of Nebuchadnezzar, then perhaps the 6th century B.C. The Persians took Babylonia 2 centuries before Alexander's time, and they bled the area dry. When Alexander arrived, it was still a vibrant city, but its best days were already far in the past. We, however, are seeing it at something close to its best." Josh studied her. "You look wistful," he says. "I was just thinking about Myra. I'd love her to be here, to be able to show her this. Maybe someday you'll be able to tell her about it." "Yeah, right." Ruddy, Abdikadir, Eumenes, and De Morgan had followed more slowly up the ziggurat. Ruddy was wheezing, but he made it, and as he sat down, Josh clapped him on the back. Eumenes stayed standing, apparently not winded at all, and gazed out at Babylon. Abdikadir borrowed Bessessa's night goggles and looked around. "Take a look at the western side of the river." The line of the walls crossed the river to complete the city's bisected rectangle. But on the far side of the river, though Bessessa thought she could make out the lines of the streets, there was no color but the orange-brown of mudstone, and the walls were reduced to ridges of broken rubble, the gates and watchtowers just mounds of core. Josh said, "It looks as if half the city has been melted." "Or nuked," said Abdikadir grimly. Eumenes spoke. "It was not like this," De Morgan translated. "Not like this." While the eastern half of the city had been ceremonial and administrative, the western half had been residential, crowded with houses, tenement blocks, plazas, and markets. Eumenes had seen it that way only a few years before, a vibrant, crowded human city. Now it was all reduced to nothing. "Another interface," Abdikadir said grimly. "The heart of a young Babylon, transplanted into the corpse of the old." Eumenes said, "I believed I was coming to terms with the strangeness of the faults in time which afflict us. But to see this, the face of a city rubbed away into sand, the weight of 1,000 years descended in a heartbeat." "Yes," Ruddy said, "the terrible cruelty of time."
"More than cruelty," Eumenes said. "Arrogance."
Bessessa was insulated from the secretary's emotions by translation and 2 millennia of different body language. But again she thought she detected a growing cold anger in him. A voice floated up from the ground, a Macedonian officer calling for Eumenes. A search party had found somebody, a Babylonian, hiding in the temple of Marduk. 30. The Gate of the Gods. The Macedonian's captive was brought to Eumenes. He was clearly terrified, his eyes wide and a grimy face, and 2 burly troopers had to drag him. The man was dressed in fine robes, rich blue cloth inlaid with threads of gold. But the robes, ragged and dirty, hung off his frame, as if he hadn't eaten for days. He might once have been clean-shaven and his scalp scoured bare, but now a stubble of black hair was growing back, and his skin was filthy. As he was brought close, Bessessa shrank from a stink of stale urine. Prodded with a Macedonian stabbing sword, he gabbled freely, but in an antique tongue that none of the moderns recognized. The officer who had found him had had the presence of mind to find a Persian soldier who could understand this language, and so the Babylonian's words were translated into archaic Greek for Eumenes, and then English for the moderns. De Morgan, frowning, translated uncertainly, "He says he was a priest of a goddess. I can't make out the name. He was abandoned when the others finally left the temple complex. He's been too frightened to leave the temple. He has been here for 6 days and nights. He has had no food, no water, but that which he drank from the sacred font of the goddess." Eumenes snapped his fingers impatiently. "Give him food and water, and make him tell us what happened here." Bit by bit, between ravenous mouthfuls, the priest told his story. It had begun, of course, with the discontinuity. One night, the priests and other temple staff had been woken by a dreadful wailing. Some of them ran outside. It was dark, but the stars were in the wrong place. The wailing came from a temple astronomer who had been making observations of the planets, the wandering stars, as he had every night since he was a small boy. But suddenly his planet had disappeared, and the very constellations had swum around the sky. It had been the astronomers' shock and despair that had begun to rouse the temple and the rest of the city. "Of course," Abdelkadir muttered. "The Babylonians kept careful records of the sky for millennia. They based their philosophy and religion on the great cycles in the sky. It's a strange thought that a less advanced people mightn't have been so terrified." But that first astronomical trauma, really perceptible only to a religious elite, was just the precursor. For at the end of that night, the sun was late rising by 6 hours or more. And by the time it did rise, a strange hot wind was washing over the city, and rain fell, hot, salty rain of a type nobody had known before. The people, many still dressed in their nightclothes, fled to the religious district. Some ran to the temples and demanded to be shown that their gods had not abandoned them on this, the strangest dawn of Babylon's history. Others climbed the ziggurat to see what other changes the night had brought. The king was away. It wasn't clear to Bisessa whether the priest meant Nebuchadnezzar himself, or perhaps a successor, and there was nobody to impose order. And then the first panicked reports came of the erasure of the western districts. Most of the city's population had actually lived there, for the priests, ministers, court favorites, and other dignitaries left on the eastern side, the shock was overwhelming. The last vestiges of order quickly broke down. A mob had stormed the temple of Marduk itself. As many as could force their way in had rushed to the innermost chamber, and when they saw what had become of Marduk himself, king of the ancient Babylonian gods, the priest could not complete his sentence. After that final shock, a rumor had swept through the city that the eastern half would be rubbed into dust as had the western. People flung open the gates and ran, screaming, out of the city and into the land beyond. Even government ministers, army commanders, and the priests had gone, leaving only this poor wretch who had huddled in his defiled temple. Around mouthfuls of food, the priest described the nights since, as he had heard looting, burning, drunken laughter, even screaming. But whenever he had dared to poke his head out of doors in the daylight, he had seen nobody. It was clear that most of the population had vanished into the parched land beyond the cultivated fragment, there to die of thirst or starvation. Eumenes ordered his men to clean up the priest and present him to the king. Then he said, "This priest says the old name of the city is the Gate of the Gods. How appropriate, for now that gate has opened." "Come!" Eumenes strode forward. The others hurried after him. Ruddy gasped, "Where are we going now?" Bisessa said, "Why, to the temple of Marduk, of course." The temple, another great pyramidal pile, was like a cross between a cathedral and an office building. Hurrying down corridors and climbing from level to level, Bisessa passed through a bewildering variety of rooms, each elaborately decorated, containing altars, statues, friezes, and obscure-looking equipment like croziers, ornate knives, headdresses, musical instruments similar to lutes and sackbuts, even small carts and chariots. In some of the deeper rooms there were no windows, and the light came from oil lamps burning smokily in little alcoves in the walls. There was a powerful smell of incense, which De Morgan told her was frankincense. There was some evidence of minor damage, a door smashed off its heavy wooden hinges, broken pottery, a tapestry ripped off one wall. Ruddy said, "More than one god is worshipped here, that's for sure. This is a library of worship. More gaudy polytheism." De Morgan muttered, "I can barely make out the gods for the gold. Look at it. It's everywhere." Bisessa said, "Once I visited Vatican City, it was like this. Wealth plastered to every surface, so dense you could barely pick out details." "Yes," Ruddy said, "and the same causes, the peculiar hold religion has on the mind of man, and the accumulation of wealth by an ancient empire." There was some evidence of looting, though. The smashed doors, a few sockets where gems might have been lodged, but it seemed to have been half-hearted. Marduk's own chamber was at the very apex of the complex, but it was ruined, and they stood at the doorway in shock. The assessor learned later that the great statue of Marduk that had stood here had consumed 20 tons of gold. The last time Eumenes had been in this temple, the statue had gone. Centuries before Alexander's visit, the conqueror Xerxes had looted these buildings and had taken away the great golden statue. Well, the statue had been here, but it had been destroyed, melted to a puddle of gleaming slag on the floor. The walls had been reduced to bare brick, scorched by some intense heat. His Esser saw ashen fragments, the remains of tapestry or carpet. Only the statue's base remained, softened and rounded, with perhaps the faintest trace of two mighty feet. And hanging in the air at the center of the burned-out temple, mysterious, unsupported, perfect, was an eye. Immense, much bigger than any others they had seen, perhaps 3 meters across. Josh whistled,
"Apti, you're going to need a big bucket to dunk that."
Isessa walked toward the eye. In the uncertain light from the oil lamps, she could see her own distorted reflection looming larger, as if the other Bessessa, contained in the eye like a fish in a bowl, was swimming to the glass to see her. She felt no heat, no sign of the great energies that had gutted this chamber. She lifted her hand and held it close to the eye. She felt as if she was pushing against some invisible but resilient barrier. The harder she pushed, the more she was repelled. And she felt a subtle sideways pull. Josh and Abdikadir were both watching her with some concern. Josh came up to her.
"Are you all right, Biss? Can't you feel it?"
"What?" She looked into the sphere.
"A presence."
Abdikadir said, "If this is the source of the electromagnetic signals we have been monitoring..."
"I can hear them now."
Her phone whispered from her pocket.
"More than that," she said.
There was something here, she thought. An awareness. Yes. Or at least a watchfulness, a huge cathedral-like watchfulness, which drew her up helplessly. But she didn't even know how she knew this. She shook her head, and something of that mysterious sense of presence dissipated. Yumini's face was like thunder.
"So now we know how Babylon was destroyed."
To Bessessa's astonishment, he picked up a golden staff from the floor. He wielded it over his head like a club, bringing it down on the unresponsive hide of the eye. The club was left bent over, the eye unmarked.
"Well, this arrogant god of the eye may find Alexander, son of Zeus, Amun, a tougher opponent than Marduk."
He turned to the moderns. "There is much to do. I will need your help and insight."
Abdikadir said, "We should use the city as a base. That much is obvious. Move the army in. We have to think about the water supply, food. And we need to set up routines like fire watches, guard patrols, repair crews."
Josh said, "If the residential half of the city is gone, we've a lot of building to do."
"I think we will all be under tents for a while yet," Abdikadir said ruefully. "We will send our scouts to map the countryside," Eumenes said. "And we will coax the farmers from their mud huts. Or we will take their farms and run them for them. I don't know any more if it is summer or winter, but here in Babylonia we can grow crops all year round."
He gazed up at the impassive eye.
"Alexander was to make this his imperial capital. Well, so it will become. The capital of a new world, perhaps."
Casey came bustling into the chamber. His expression was grim.
"We've had a message."
Bessessa remembered what time of day it was. He'd been due to try to pick up the cosmonauts' radio signals.
"From Kolya and Sable?"
"Yeah."
"That's wonderful."
"No, it isn't. We've got a problem."
31. Ham Radio. In the luggage he had been allowed to bring on the Mongols' transcontinental trek, Kolya had made sure he packed up the ham radio gear from the Soyuz. Some instinct had always made him keep this secret even from Sable, who had long lost interest in what had once been her project, and he was glad of that now. Once Genghis Khan established his base camp a few tens of kilometers from Babylon, he retrieved the gear and set it up. Oddly, this wasn't difficult. In the retinue of Yelü, the Mongol guards were watchful, but they had no idea what he was doing with his anonymous boxes and cables and spidery antennae. It was more difficult, in fact, but crucial, to keep what he was doing secret from Sable, at least for a few more hours. He knew he would get only one chance at this. He prayed for a decent transmission path and for Casey to be listening. Well, the path was poor. The post-discontinuity ionosphere seemed to be suffering, and the signal was obscured by static, pops, and whoops. But Casey was indeed listening, At the Daily Times, they had agreed when Kolya was still orbiting the world in Soyuz, in the impossible and lost past. Kolya wasn't surprised to know that Casey and the others had traveled to Babylon. It was a logical destination, and they discussed the possibility before he had left orbit. But he was stunned to learn who Casey had traveled with. Stunned, yet hopeful. For perhaps there was, after all, a force in the world that could resist Genghis Khan. Kolya longed to prolong the contact, to listen to this man from the 21st century, his own time. He felt that Casey, who he had never even met in person, had become his closest friend in the world. But there was no time for that. There were no choices left, no more luxuries for Kolya. He talked and talked, describing everything he knew about Genghis Khan, his army, his tactics. And he spoke of Sable and what she had done, and what he suspected she was capable of. He talked as long as he could. It turned out to be about half an hour. Then Sable showed up with two burly Mongol guards who hauled him back from the radio and briskly smashed up the gear with the butts of their lances. 32. Council of War. Alexander's scouts brought the news that the vanguard of the Mongol army was only a few days' ride away. To his advisor's surprise, the king ordered that a parley should be attempted. Alexander was horrified by what the moderns had to tell him of the destruction that had been wrought by the Mongol expansion. Alexander might be a blood-stained conqueror himself, but he had ambitions beyond simple conquest. His intent was certainly more sophisticated than Genghis Khan's, 15 centuries after his own time. He was determined to oppose the Mongols, but Alexander was of a mind to build something new in this empty world, not to destroy. He said to his advisers, "We and our red-coated comrades from beyond the ocean, and these horsemen from the wastes of Asia, are all survivors of dislocations in time and space, wonders beyond the anticipation of any man. Do we have no other response to all this than to slaughter each other? Is there nothing for us to learn from each other but weapons and tactics?" So he ordered a party of envoys to be sent out, with gifts and tributes, to open a dialogue with the Mongol leaders. It would travel with an impressive force of 1,000 men, and was to be under the command of Ptolemy. Ptolemy was one of the king's closest companions, a Macedonian and a friend of Alexander from childhood. A hard-faced warrior, he was a dark, silent man, and evidently shrewd. Perhaps he was a good choice for such a delicate mission. Assessor's phone told her that in another reality, Ptolemy would, in the carve-up of Alexander's conquests after his death, have become pharaoh of the ancient kingdom of Egypt. But as he prepared for the mission, Ptolemy stamped around the royal palace looking thunderous. Bisessa wondered if his appointment to this perilous and highly likely fatal mission had anything to do with the endless maneuverings and intrigues among Alexander's inner circle. At Abdikadir's suggestion, Captain Grove attached the competent Geordie Corporal Batson and a few British troops to the party. It had been proposed that one of Vassessa's group should go along, since Sable was believed to be at the heart of the assault they anticipated. But Alexander decreed that his three refugees from the 21st century were too few to be risked on such a venture, and that was that. Still, at Eumenes's suggestion, Vassessa drafted a note for Batson to give to Kolya, in case he encountered the cosmonaut. The party marched out of the gates of Babylon. They set off to the east, with the Macedonian officers in their dress uniforms with bright purple cloaks, and Corporal Batson and the other British in their kilts and their serge, all to the din of trumpets and drums. Alexander was a hardened warrior, and while he hoped for peace, he prepared for war. In Babylon, Bisessa, Abdikadir, and Casey, along with Captain Grove and a number of his officers, were summoned to a war council. Like the Ishtar Gate, the royal palace of Babylon sat on a platform raised some 15 meters above the riverside plain, so it loomed over the city and its surroundings. The palace was staggering, if to Bisessa's modern perspective it was an obscene demonstration of wealth, power, and oppression. Walking toward the center of the complex, they passed terraced gardens built on the roofs of the buildings. The trees looked healthy enough, but the grass was a little yellow, the flowers sickly. The gardens had been neglected since the discontinuity. But the palace was a symbol of the city and Alexander's new reign, and there was a great flurry of activity as servants ran back and forth with jars of fresh water and nutrients. These were not slaves, Bisessa learned, but some of Babylon's former dignitaries who had come creeping back from the countryside where they had fled. In the aftermath of the discontinuity, they had proved themselves cowardly. Now, at Alexander's orders, they were reduced to menial chores. At the heart of the palace complex was the king's throne room. This room alone was about 50 paces long, and every surface from floor to ceiling was coated with multicolored glazed bricks, showing lions, dragons, and stylized trees of life. The moderns walked in, their feet echoing on the glazed floor, trying not to be overwhelmed by the scale of it all. A table had been set up in the middle of the room, bearing a giant plaster model of the city, its walls, and the surrounding countryside. Perhaps 5 meters across, the model was brightly painted and full of detail, right down to the human figures in the streets and the goats in the fields. Toy canals glimmered full of real water. Bisessa and the others settled to their couches before the table, and servants brought them drinks. Bisessa said, "This was my idea. I thought a model might be easier for everyone to grasp than a map. I had no idea they would put together something on this scale, and so quickly." Captain Grove said levelly, "Shows what you can do, and you can draw on an unlimited resource of human mind and muscle." Eumenes and his advisers entered and took their places. To his huge credit in Bisessa's eyes, Eumenes showed little taste for elaborate protocols. He was far too intelligent for that. But as a member of Alexander's court, he couldn't avoid some flummery, and his advisers fluttered around him as he grandly settled to his couch. These advisers now included De Morgan, who had taken to wearing elaborate Persian dress, like others in Alexander's court. Today his face was bloated and red, his eyes marked by deep shadows. Casey said bluntly, "Cecil, my man, you look like shit, despite that cocktail dress you're wearing." De Morgan grunted. "When Alexander and his Macedonians get started on one of their debauches, they make British Tommies in the brothels of Lahore look like schoolboys. The king is sleeping it off. Sometimes he misses whole days, though he's always awake for the evenings when it all starts again." De Morgan accepted a goblet of wine from a servant. "And this Macedonian wine is like goat's urine. But still, hair of the dog." He took a deep draught, shuddering. Eumenes called the meeting to order. Captain Grove began to set out ideas on how to strengthen Babylon's already formidable defenses. He said to Eumenes, "I know you already have crews out reinforcing the walls and digging out the moat." That was especially important on the western side, where the walls had been all but rubbed out by time. In fact, the Macedonians had decided to abandon the western side of the city and use the Euphrates itself as a natural barrier, and were building up defenses on its bank. "But," said Grove, "I would recommend setting up deeper defenses further out, especially to the east, where the Mongols will be coming from. I'm thinking of pillboxes and trenches. Fortifications we can set up quickly." Many of these concepts took a little translating through Eumenes' assistance and the hungover De Morgan. Eumenes listened patiently for a while. "I will have Diades look into this." Diades was Alexander's chief engineer. "But you must know that the king is not mindful simply to defend. Of all the fields on which he has fought, Alexander is most proud of his victorious sieges at Miletus, on Tyre, and a dozen other examples. These are epic triumphs that will surely echo down the ages." Captain Grove nodded. "Indeed they do. What I think you're telling us is that Alexander won't be content to be the victim of a siege himself. He is going to want to ride out on the field and meet the Mongols in open battle."
"Yes," murmured Abdelkader. "But the Mongols, by comparison, were poor at siege warfare, and much preferred to meet their enemies on open ground. If we ride out, we meet our enemies on the field of their choice."
Eumenes growled, "The king has spoken." Grove said quietly,
"Then we must listen."
"But," said Abdelkader, "Alexander and Genghis are separated by more than 15 centuries, far longer than separates Genghis from us. We should exploit every advantage we have."
Eumenes said smoothly,
"Advantages? You mean your guns and grenades?"
Again he used the English words. Since meeting Alexander's army, the British and the moderns had tried to keep back some secrets from the Macedonians. Now Casey jumped off his couch and reached across the table toward De Morgan.
"Cecil, you bastard! What else have you given away?"
De Morgan cowered back out of his reach, and two of Eumenes' guards hurried forward, their broad hands on their stabbing swords. Abdelkader and Grove grabbed Casey and pulled him back down. Bisessa sighed. "Come on, Casey, what did you expect?
You know what Cecil's like by now. He'd offer Eumenes your testicles on a plate if he thought it would be to his advantage.
Abdicadir said, and Eumenes probably knew about it all anyhow. These Macedonians aren't fools. Eumenes followed these exchanges with interest. He said, you forget that Cecil may not have had a choice in what he told me. De Morgan translated this hesitantly, his eyes averted, and Bessessa saw the dark side of the choice he had made. And besides, Eumenes went on, my foreknowledge will save us time. Now we need it, won't it? Captain Grove leaned forward. But you must understand, Secretary, that our weapons, though formidable, are limited. We have only a small stock of grenades and ammunition for the guns. The most significant armament was 19th century vintage, a few hundred Martini rifles brought from Jamrud. Such a number of weapons wouldn't count for much against a fast-moving horde numbered in the tens of thousands. Eumenes quickly grasped these ideas. So we have to be selective about how we use these weapons.
Exactly, Casey growled.
Okay, if we commit to this, we should use the modern weapons to blunt their first attack.
Yes, said Abdicadir.
Flashbang grenades will spook the horses.
And the men, if they're unused to firearms.
Bessessa said, but they have sable. We don't know what weapons came down in that Soyuz with her. Surely at least a couple of pistols.
That won't help her much, said Casey.
No, but if she's thrown in her lot with the Mongols, she may have used them to familiarize the Mongols with firearms. But she has modern training. We have to plan for the possibility that they'll come in anticipating what we might do.
Shit, said Casey. Hadn't thought of that.
All right, Captain Grove said.
Casey, what else do you suggest?
Prepare for firefights in the city, Casey said.
Quickly, the moderns sketched out the discipline for Eumenes. How you could anticipate the enemy's likely approaches and set up interlocking firing positions and so forth.
We'll have to train up some of your men in using the Kalashnikovs, said Casey to Grove. The key will be not to waste ammo, not to fire until we have a clear target. If we draw the Mongols into the city, it's possible we could soak up a large proportion of their forces.
Again, Eumenes grasped the ideas quickly.
But Babylon would be destroyed in the process, he said.
Casey shrugged.
Winning this war is going to be costly, and if we lose, Babylon dies anyhow.
Eumenes said, perhaps this tactic should be a last resort. Anything else? Bessessa said, of course it's not just guns we've brought with us from the future, but knowledge. We may be able to suggest weapons that could be built with the resources available here.
Casey said, what are you thinking, Bess?
I've seen those kit-form catapults and siege engines the Macedonians have. Maybe we could come up with some improvements. And then how about Greek fire? Wasn't that a primitive form of napalm? Just naphtha and quicklime, I think.
They discussed such possibilities for a while, but Eumenes cut them short.
I only dimly grasp what you describe, but I fear there will not be enough time to implement such schemes.
I've got something that could be delivered quickly, Abdicadir murmured.
What?
Bessessa asked. Stirrups. Sketching quickly, he described what he meant. A kind of footrest for horsemen, attached by leather straps. When Eumenes understood that these devices, quickly and simply manufactured, could multiply a cavalry's maneuverability, he became extremely interested.
But our companions are men of tradition. They will resist any innovation.
But, Abdicadir pointed out, the Mongols have stirrups. There was a great deal to be put in place, and little time to do it. The meeting broke up. Bessessa drew Abdicadir and Casey to one side.
You really think this battle is inevitable?
Yeah, Casey growled. Alternatives to war, non-violent means of resolving disputes, depend on the willingness of everybody concerned to back down. Back in the Iron Age, these guys haven't had the benefit of our experience of 2,000 years of bloodshed, give or take a few Hiroshimas and Lahores, to learn that it is sometimes necessary to back down. For them, war is the only way.
Bessessa studied him.
That's surprisingly thoughtful for you, Casey.
Shucks, he said.
But he quickly relapsed into his jock act. He cackled and rubbed his hands.
But it's fun, too. You know, we've got ourselves in a crock of shit here. But think about it.
Alexander the Great versus Genghis Khan. I wonder what they'd charge on pay-per-view for that.
Bisessa knew what he meant. She had trained as a soldier, too, mixed in with her dread and her wish that none of this was happening, that she could just go home, was anticipation. They walked out of the throne room, talking, speculating, and planning. 33. A Prince of Heaven. After a day and night alone in the dark, Collier was taken to Yelü. His arms pinned behind his back by horsehair rope, he was thrown to the ground. He had no desire to face torture, and he talked fast, telling Yelü what he had done, as much as he could remember. At the end of it, Yelü walked out of the yurt. Sable's face loomed over him. "You shouldn't have done it, Cole. The Mongols know the power of information. You saw that for yourself at Bishkek. You could hardly have committed a worse crime if you'd taken a swipe at Genghis himself." He whispered, "Can I have some water?" He'd had nothing since being discovered. She ignored his request. "You know there's only going to be one verdict. I tried to plead your case. I said you were a prince of heaven. They'll be lenient. They don't spill royal blood." He found the phlegm to spit in her face. The last time he saw her, she was laughing down at him. They took him outside, hands still behind his back. Four burly soldiers held him down at his shoulders, his legs. Then an officer emerged from a yurt, his hands heavily gloved, carrying a ceramic cup. The cup turned out to contain molten silver. They poured it into one eye, then the other, and then one ear, and the other. After that, he could feel them pick him up, carry him, throw him into a hole lined with soft, fresh dug earth. He could not hear the hammering as they nailed down the floorboards over his head, nor could he hear his own screams. 34. Dwellers all in time and space. Alexander threw his army into a strict regimen of training. Most of this followed traditional Macedonian methods, involving a lot of forced marching, running under weights, and hand-to-hand combat. But there were attempts to integrate the British troops into the Macedonian force. After a few trials, it was clear that no British rider or sowar was good enough to ride with Alexander's cavalry. But the Tommies and Sepoys were accepted into the heart of the Macedonian infantry, the foot companions. Given the language and culture clashes, a unified chain of command was hardly possible. But the Tommies were trained to understand the Macedonian trumpeter's key signals. Abdikadir's work with the cavalry made fast strides, even though, as Eumenes had predicted, the first attempts to have the Macedonians ride with Abdikadir's prototype stirrups were farcical. The companion cavalry, the army's senior regiment, was recruited from the youth of Macedonian nobles. Alexander sported a version of their uniform himself. And when they were first offered stirrups, the proud companions just sliced off the dangling leather attachments with their scimitars. It took a brave sowar to climb onto one of the Macedonian stocky horses, and inexpertly but effectively show how tightly he was able to control even an unfamiliar horse. After that, and with some heavy pressure relayed from the king, the training began in earnest. Even without stirrups, though, the Macedonian's horsemanship was astonishing. The rider steadied himself by holding onto the horse's mane, and steered his horse purely by the pressure of his knees. Even so, the companions were able to skirmish and wheel sharply, a flexibility and agility that had made them the hardened, cutting edge of Alexander's forces. Now, with stirrups, their maneuverability was vastly improved, and a companion could brace his legs against impact and support a heavy lance. "They're just remarkable," Abdikadir said as he watched wedges of 100 men wheel and dart as one across the fields of Babylon. "I almost regret giving them stirrups. A couple of generations and this kind of horsemanship will be forgotten." "But we'll still need horses," Casey growled. "Makes you think. Horses would be the main engine of war for another 23 centuries. Until World War I, for God's sake." "Maybe it will be different here," Bisessa mused. "Right. We're not the same half-insane bunch of squabbling, over-promoted primates we were before the discontinuity. The fact that we're immersed in a battle with the Mongols 5 minutes after arriving here is just an aberration." Casey laughed and walked away. Grove arranged for the Macedonians to be given some exposure to gunfire. In squads of 1,000 or more, the Macedonians watched as Grove or Casey sacrificed a little of their stock of modern weaponry. a grenade, or a few shots squeezed off a martini or a Kalashnikov at a tethered goat. Assessor had argued that this kind of conditioning was essential. Let them piss their pants now, but hold the line against the Mongols. In case Sabu had similar surprises up her spacesuit sleeve. The Macedonians had no trouble in grasping the principles of firearms. Killing at a distance with bows was familiar to them. But the first time the Macedonians saw a relatively harmless flashbang grenade go off, they yelled and ran, regardless of the harangues of their officers. It would have been comical if not so alarming. With Grove's support, Abdelkader insisted that Possessor shouldn't take part in the fighting directly. A woman would be particularly vulnerable. Grove, quaintly, actually used the phrase, a fate worse than death. So Possessor threw herself into another project, establishing a hospital. She requisitioned a small Babylonian townhouse. Philip, Alexander's personal physician, and the British surgeon captain both assigned her assistance. She was grievously short of any kind of supplies, but what she lacked in resources, she tried to compensate for in modern know-how. She experimented with wine as an antiseptic. She established casualty collection points across the likely battlefield and trained pairs of Alexander's powerful, long-legged agrarian scouts to work as stretcher-bearers. She tried to set up trauma chests, simple packs of equipment to serve the basis of the most likely injuries they would encounter, even gunshot wounds. This was an innovation of the British Army in the Falklands, who made a quick assessment of the injury, then just grabbed the most appropriate kit. The hardest thing to impart was the need for hygiene. Neither Macedonians nor 19th-century Brits grasped the need even to wipe off the blood between treating one patient and another. The Macedonians were baffled by her vague talk of invisible creatures, like tiny gods or demons attacking broken flesh or exposed organs. And the British were scarcely any the wiser about bacteria and viruses. In the end, she had to appeal to their respective command structures to enforce her will. She gave her assistants what practice she could. She sacrificed more goats, hacking at the animals with a Macedonian scimitar, or shooting them in the gut or pelvis. There was no substitute for getting your hands in real gore. The Macedonians were not squeamish. To have survived with Alexander, most of them had seen enough terrible injuries in their time. But the notion of doing something about it was new to them. The effectiveness of even simple techniques like tourniquets startled them and inspired them to work harder, learning all the time. Once again, she was changing the trajectory of history, Possessor thought. If they survived, a big if. She wondered what new medical synthesis 2,000 years early might develop from the rough-and-ready education she was struggling to impart. Perhaps a whole new body of knowledge, functionally equivalent to the mechanical Newtonian models of the 21st century, but couched in the language of Macedonian gods. Ruddy Kipling insisted on joining up, as he called it. Here I stand at the confluence of history as mankind's two greatest generals join in combat with the prize, the destiny of a new world. My blood is up, Possessor. He had, he claimed, trained with the 1st Punjab Volunteer Rifles, part of an Anglo-Indian initiative to fend off the threats emanating from the rebellious northwest frontier. Granted, I didn't last very long, he admitted, after mocking my fellow recruits' shooting skills in a little poem about having my carcass peppered with bullets while walking down a neighboring street. The British took one look at this broad-faced, pudgy, somewhat pompous young man, still pale from his lingering illness, and laughed at him. The Macedonians were simply baffled by Ruddy, but wouldn't have him either. After these rebuffs, and somewhat against Possessor's better judgment, Ruddy insisted on joining her makeshift medical corps. I once had some ambition to be a doctor, you know. Perhaps, but he turned out to be astoundingly squeamish, fainting dead away the first time he glimpsed a goat's fresh blood. But, determined to play his part in the great struggle, he stuck with it. Gradually, he became inured to the atmosphere of a hospital, the stink of blood, and the bleating of wounded and frightened animals. Eventually, he was able to apply a bandage to a goat's hacked-open leg, all but finishing the job before fainting. Then came his greatest triumph, when a Tommy came in with a gashed-open hand from a training accident. Ruddy was able to clean it out and bind it up without referring to Possessor, although he threw up later, as he cheerfully admitted. After that, Possessor took his shoulders, ignoring the faint stink of vomit. Ruddy, courage on the battlefield is one thing,
But no less is the courage to face one's inner demons, as you have done.
I will persuade myself to believe you,
he said, but he blushed through his pallor. Though Ruddy became able to stand the sight of blood, suffering, and death, he was still greatly moved by the spectacle, even by the death of a goat. Over dinner, he said,
what is life that it is so precious and yet so easily destroyed? Perhaps that wretched kid we shot to bits today thought himself the center of the universe, and now he is snuffed out, evanescent as a dewdrop. Why would God give us something so precious as life, only to hack it short with the brutality of death?
But, De Morgan said, it isn't just God that we can ask now. We can no longer regard ourselves as the pinnacle of creation below God himself. But now we have in our world these creatures whom possess our senses inside the eyes. Perhaps below God, but higher than us, as we are higher than the kid goats we slaughter. Why should God listen to our prayers when they stand over us to call to him?
Ruddy looked at him with disgust. That's typical of you, De Morgan, to belittle your fellow man. De Morgan just laughed. Josh said, or maybe there is no God of the discontinuity. He sounded unusually troubled. You know, this whole experience, everything since the discontinuity, is so like a terrible dream, a fever dream. Professor, you have taught me about the great extinctions of the past. You say this was understood in my time, but barely accepted. And you say that in all the fossil record, there is no trace of mind. Nothing until man and his immediate precursors. Perhaps then, if we are to die ourselves, it will be the first time an intelligent species has succumbed to extinction. He flexed his hand, studying his fingers. Dr. Kadir says that according to the scientists of the 21st century, mind is bound up with the structure of the universe. That mind somehow makes things real. The collapse of quantum functions.
Yes, perhaps.
If that is so, and if our kind of minds are about to be snuffed out, then perhaps this is the consequence. They say that when you face death, your past life flickers before your eyes. Perhaps we as a race are undergoing a final psychic shock as we succumb to darkness. Shards of our bloody history have come bubbling to the surface in the last instance. And perhaps in falling, we are smashing apart the structure of space and time itself. He was talking rapidly now, disturbed. Ruddy just laughed. Look like you to brood so, Josh.
Professor reached out and took Josh's hand.
Shut up, Ruddy. Listen to me, Josh. This is no death dream. I think the eyes are artifacts. The discontinuity a purposeful act. I think there are minds involved. Minds greater than ours, but like ours. But, De Morgan said grimly, your creatures of the eye can shuffle space and time themselves. What is that but the preserve of a god? Oh, I don't think they are gods, Decessa said. Powerful, yes, far beyond us, but not gods. Josh said, why do you say that? Because they have no compassion.
They had 4 days' grace. Then Alexander's envoys returned. Of the 1,000 men who rode out, only 12 came back. Corporal Batson lived, but his ears and nose had been sliced off. And in a bag on his saddle, he carried the severed head of Ptolemy. When she heard the news, Bessessa shuddered, both at the imminent prospect of war and the loss of another thread from history's unraveling fabric. The news about Batson, the competent Geordie soldier, broke her heart. She heard that Alexander simply mourned the loss of his friend. The next day, the Macedonian scouts reported much activity in the Mongol camp. The assault, it seemed, was close. That afternoon, Josh found Bessessa in the temple of Marduk. She was sitting against one scorched and blackened wall, a British blanket over her legs to keep out the gathering cold. She stared up at the eye, which they had labeled the Eye of Marduk, although some of the Tommies called it God's Bollock. Bessessa had taken to spending much of her spare time in here. Josh sat down beside her, arms wrapped around his thin torso. You're supposed to be resting.
I am resting. Resting and watching. Watching the watchers?
She smiled.
Somebody has to. I don't want them to think.
What?
That we don't know about them.
what they've done to us, our history. And besides, I think there is power here. There must be, to have created this eye and its siblings across the planet, to have melted 20 tons of gold to a puddle. I don't want Sable or Genghis Khan come to that, to get our hands on it. If it all goes pear-shaped when the Mongols come, I'll be standing in that doorway with my pistol. Oh, Bessessa, you are so strong. I wish I was like you. No, you don't.
He was holding her hand very tightly, but she didn't try to pull away. Here. She fumbled under the blanket and produced a metallic flask. Have some tea. He opened the flask and sipped.
It's good. The milk is a little, not authentic. From my survival pack. Condensed and irradiated. In the American Army, they give you suicide pills. In the British, tea. I've been saving it for a special occasion. What more special than this?
He sipped the tea. He seemed turned in on himself. Bessessa wondered if the shock of the discontinuity was at last working its way through Josh. It had hit them all, she suspected, in different ways. She asked, "Are you okay?" "Just thinking of home." She nodded. "None of us talks much about home, do we? Perhaps it's too painful. Tell me anyhow, Josh. Tell me about your family."
"As a journalist, I'm following my father. He covered the war between the states."
Which was, Bessessa reflected, only 20 years in the past for Josh.
"He took a bullet in the hip. Eventually got infected. Took him a couple of years to die."
"I was only 7, Josh whispered.
"I asked him why he had become a journalist rather than go fight. He said that somebody has to watch, to tell others. Otherwise, it's as if it never really happened at all. Well, I believed him and followed in his footsteps. Sometimes I resented the fact that the pattern of my life was somewhat fixed before I was born. But I suppose that's not uncommon.
Ask Alexander."
"Yeah. My mother is still alive, or was. I wish I could tell her I'm safe. Maybe she knows, somehow. Yes, I know who you would be with if..."
"My little girl," his sister said.
"You never told me about her father."
She shrugged. "A good-looking bum from my regiment. Think of Casey without the charm and sense of personal hygiene. We had a fling and I got careless. Drunkenness against which there is no prophylactic. When Myra was born, Mike was confused. He wasn't a bad guy, but I didn't care by then. I wanted her, not him. And then he got himself killed anyhow." She felt her eyes prickle. She pressed the heel of her palm into their sockets.
"I was away from home for months at a time. I knew I wasn't spending enough time with Myra. I always promised myself I'd do better, but could never get my life together. Now I'm stuck here, and I have to deal with Genghis fucking Khan when all I want is to go home."
Josh cupped her face with his hand.
"None of us wants this," he said. "But at least we have each other. And if I die tomorrow..."
"Yes, do you believe that we will come back? That if there is some new chopping up of time, we will live again?"
"No. Or there may be another Bessessa Dot. But it won't be me."
"Then this moment is all we have," he whispered.
After that, it seemed inevitable. Their lips met, their teeth touched, and she pulled him under her blanket, ripping at his clothes. He was gentle and fumbling and near virgin, but he came to her with a desperate, needy passion, which found an echo in herself. She immersed herself in the ancient liquid warmth of the moment. But when it was over, she thought of Myra and probed at her guilt like a broken tooth. She found only emptiness inside, like a space where Myra had once been and was now vanished for good. And she was always aware of the eye hovering above them both balefully, and the reflections of herself and Josh like insects pinned to its glistening hide. At the end of the day, Alexander, having completed his sacrifices in advance of the battle, gave orders that his army should be assembled. The tens of thousands of them drew up in their squads before the walls of Babylon, their tunics bright and shields polished, their horses whinnying and bucking. The few hundred British, too, were drawn up by grove in parade order, their khaki and red serge proud, their arms presented. Alexander mounted his horse and rode before his army, haranguing them with a strong, clear voice that echoed from Babylon's walls. Gisessa would never have guessed at the wounds he carried. She couldn't follow his words, but there was no mistaking the response. The rattle of tens of thousands of swords against shields, and the Macedonians' ferocious battle cry, "Alalalai! Alejandre! Alejandre!" Then Alexander rode to the small section of British. Holding his horse steady with his hand wrapped in its mane, he spoke again, but in English. His voice was heavily accented, but his words were easily comprehensible. He talked of Omet Kel and Maiwand, battles of the British Empire's Second Afghan War that loomed large in the barrack-room mythology of these troops, and the memory of some of them. And Alexander said, "From this day to the ending of the world, but in it we shall be remembered, we few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother." The Europeans and sepoys alike cheered as loud as any Macedonian. Casey Offic bellowed, "Heard, acknowledged, understood." When the parade broke up, Bisessa sought out Ruddy. He was standing on the platform of the Ishtar Gate, looking out over the plain where the fires of the soldiers' camp were already alight under a darkling slate-gray sky. He was smoking one of his last Turkish cigarettes, saved for the occasion, he said.
"Shakespeare, Ruddy? Henry the Fifth, to be exact."
He was puffed up, visibly proud of himself.
"Alexander heard I was something of a wordsmith, so he called me to the palace to concoct a short address for him to deliver to our Tommies. Rather than something of my own, I turned to the bard, and what could be more fitting? And besides," he said, "as the old boy probably never even existed in this new universe, he can hardly sue for plagiarism." "You're quite a package, Ruddy."
As the light faded, the soldiers had begun singing. The Macedonian songs were the usual mournful dirges about home and lost loved ones. But tonight Bisessa heard English words, an oddly familiar refrain. Ruddy smiled. "Do you recognize it? It's a hymn. Praise my soul, the King of Heaven. Given our situation, I think one of those Tommies has a sense of humor. Listen to the last verse. Angels help us to adore him. Ye behold him face to face. Sun and moon bow down before him, dwellers all in time and space. Praise him, praise him, praise him, praise him. Praise with us the God of grace." As they sang, the accents of London, Newcastle, Glasgow, Liverpool, and the Punjab merged into one. But a soft wind blew from the east, wafting the smoke of the fires over the walls of the city. When Bisessa looked that way, she saw that the eyes had returned, dozens of them, hovering expectantly over the fields of Babylonia. 35. Confluence. The dust. That was what Josh saw first. A great cloud of it kicked up by racing hooves. It was about midday. But once it was a clear, bright day, and the rolling bank of dust, perhaps half a kilometer wide, was filled with smoky, light, elusive shapes. Then, in Josh's clear view, they emerged from the dusty glow, shadows at first, coalescing into figures of stocky menace. They were Mongol warriors, identifiable at a glance. Despite all that had happened to him, Josh had found it hard to believe that a Mongol horde, under the control of Genghis Khan himself, was really and truly approaching, intent on killing him. And yet it was so. He could see it with his own eyes. He felt his heart beat faster. He was sitting in a cramped guard position on the Ishtar Gate, looking out over the plain to the east toward the Mongol advance. With him were Macedonians and a couple of British. The British had decent pairs of binoculars, Swiss-made. Grove had impressed on them the importance of keeping the lenses shielded. They had no idea how much information Genghis Khan had about their situation here in Babylon. But Sable Jones would surely understand the significance of a glinting reflection. The best equipped of all was Josh, though, for Abdelkadir, who had gone off to fight, had bequeathed him his precious NODs, the far-sighted night-vision glasses that one wore like goggles. At the first glimpse of the Mongols among Macedonians and British observers alike, there was an air of tension, and yet of excitement, a palpable thrill. On the next gate, Josh thought he saw the brightly colored chest plate of Alexander himself come to view this first clash. The Mongols came in a long line and seemed to be grouped into units of 10 or so. Josh counted the units quickly. The Mongol line was perhaps 20 men deep but 200 wide, a force of 4,000 or 5,000 men just in this first approach. But Alexander had drawn up 10,000 of his own men on the plain before Babylon. Their long scarlet cloaks billowed in the breeze, and their bronze helmets were painted sky blue, the spines of their crests marked with the insignia of rank. It started. The first assault was with arrows. The front ranks of the advancing Mongols lifted complicated-looking compound bows and fired into the air. The bows were of laminated horn and could strike accurately over hundreds of yards, as fast as a warrior could pull arrows from his quiver. The Macedonians had been drawn up into two long files, with the foot companions at the center and the elite shield-bearers guarding either flank. Now, as the arrows flew to brisk drumbeats and trumpet peals, they quickly regrouped into a close order, box-like formation, 8 men deep. They raised their leather shields over their heads and locked them together like the formation the Romans had called the turtle. The arrows fell on the shields with audible thumps. The shell formation held, but it wasn't perfect. Here and there men dropped to sharp cries, and there would be a brief hole in the cover, a fast flurry as the wounded man was dragged from the formation and the shell would close up again. So men had already started to die, Josh thought. Perhaps a quarter mile from the city walls, the Mongols suddenly broke into a charge. The warriors roared, their war drums banged like a pulse, and even the clatter of the horses' hooves was like a storm. The wave of noise was startling. Josh didn't believe he was a coward, but he couldn't help but quail, and he was astonished at how calmly Alexander's seasoned warriors held their places. To more trumpet peals and yelled commands, "Sinas pismos!" They broke up their turtle formation and formed their open lines once more, though some kept their shields raised to ward off arrows. They were in a line 4 deep now, with some troops held in reserve at the back. They were infantrymen facing the Mongols' cavalry charge. A thin line of flesh and blood was all that stood between Babylon and the oncoming Mongols. But they locked their buttoned shields together and rammed the butts of their long spears in the ground, and foot-long iron blades bristled at the oncoming Mongols. In the last moments, Josh saw the Mongols very clearly, even the eyes of their armored horses. The animals seemed crazed. He wondered what goads or drugs the Mongols used to induce their horses to attack packed infantry. The Mongols fell on the Macedonian lines. It was a brutal collision. The armored horses battered away through the Macedonian front line, and the whole formation buckled at the center. But the Macedonians' rear lines cut at the animals, killing or hamstringing them. Mongols and their horses began to fall, and their rear line slammed into the stalled advance. All along the Macedonian line now there was a stationary front of fighting. A stink of dust and metal, and the coppery smell of blood rose up to Josh. There were cries of rage and pain and the clash of iron on iron. There were no gunshots, no cannon roars, none of the dark, explosive noises of the warfare of later centuries. But human lives were erased with industrial efficiency, all the same. Josh was suddenly aware of a silvered sphere hovering before him, high over the ground, but almost at his own eye level. It was an eye. Perhaps, he thought grimly, there were other than human observers here today. The first assault lasted only minutes, and then to a trumpet call the Mongols suddenly broke away. Those still mounted galloped back from the fray. They left behind a line of broken and writhing bodies, severed limbs, maimed horses. The Mongols paused in loose order a few hundred yards from the Macedonian position. They called insults in their incomprehensible language, shot off a few arrows, even spat at the Macedonians. One of them had dragged a wretched Macedonian foot soldier with him, and now, with mocking elaboration, began to carve a hole in the living man's chest. The Macedonians responded with insults of their own, but when a unit ran forward, weapons raised, their officers roared commands for them to hold their positions. The Mongols continued to withdraw, still taunting the Macedonians, but Alexander's soldiers would not follow. As the lull continued, stretcher bearers ran out from the Ishtar gate. The first Macedonian warrior to be brought into Bessessa's surgery had suffered a leg wound. Ruddy helped her haul the unconscious figure onto a table. The arrow had been broken and pulled out, but it had passed right through the calf muscle and out the other side of the leg. It didn't look to have broken any bones, but flaps of muscle tissue spilled out of the raw wound. She stuffed the muscle tissue back into the hole, packed some wine-soaked cloth into it, and then, with Ruddy's brisk help, bound it up tight. The soldier was stirring. She had no anesthetic, of course, but perhaps if he woke, fear and adrenaline would keep the pain at bay a while. Ruddy, working with both hands, wiped sweat from his broad, pale brow under the shoulder of his jacket. Ruddy, you're doing fine.
Yes, and this man will live, will he not? And walk out, scimitar and shield in hand, to die on some other battlefield. All we can do is patch them up.
Yes, but there was no time, no time. The leg wound was just the first of a flood of stretcher-bound invalids that suddenly flowed in through the Ishtar gate. Philip, Alexander's physician, ran to meet the flow, and as Becessa had taught him, began to operate a brisk triage, separating those who could be helped from those who could not, and sending the invalids to where they could best be treated. She had Macedonian porters take the leg wound away to a casualty tent and grab the next stretcher in line. It turned out to be a fallen Mongol warrior. He had taken a sword blow to his upper thigh and blood pumped from an artery. She tried to press the edges of the wound together, but it was surely too late, and already the flow was stilling of its own accord. Ruddy said, "This man shouldn't have been let in here in the first place." Her hands soaked in blood, panting hard, Becessa stepped back. "There's nothing we can do for him anyhow. Get him out of here. Next!" It continued through the early afternoon, a flow of maimed and writhing bodies, and they all worked on until they felt they could work no more, and continued anyhow. Abdikadir was with the forces outside the walls of Babylon. He had already come close to the fighting when the Macedonian line had nearly buckled. But he and the British, and Casey somewhere else in the line, had been kept in the reserves, their firearms concealed under Macedonian cloaks. Their moment would come, Alexander had promised them, but not yet, not yet. Alexander and his modern advisers had the perspective of a different history to aid them. They knew the Mongols' classic tactics. The first Mongol assault had been only a feint, intended to draw the Macedonians into a pursuit. They would have been prepared to withdraw for days, if necessary, exhausting and dividing Alexander's forces, until at last they were ready to snap closed their trap. The moderns had told Alexander how the Mongols had once broken an army of Christian knights in Poland by luring them in this way. And in fact, Alexander himself had faced Scythian horsemen who used similar tactics. He would have none of it. Besides, Alexander was playing his own game of concealment, with half his infantry and all his cavalry still hidden inside the walls of Babylon, and with weapons of the 19th and 21st centuries still unused. It might work. Though Mongol scouts had been spotted in the countryside around Babylon, it was scarcely possible for spies of Genghis Khan to penetrate the city undercover. Despite the defenders' tense anticipation, the Mongols did not come again that day. As the evening gathered, a great line of campfires could be seen on the horizon, stretching from north to south, as if encircling the world. Abdikadir was aware of muttering among the men at the apparent awesome size of the Mongol force. They might have been more scared, he mused, if they had been told that among the long lines of the Mongols' yurts had been spotted the unmistakable dome shape of a spacecraft. But Alexander himself came walking through the camp, with Hephaestion and Eumenes at his side. The king was limping slightly, but his helmet and breastplate of iron gleamed like silver. Everywhere he walked, he joked with his men. The Mongols were faking, he claimed. They had probably lit two or three fires for every man they had out in the field. Why, they had been known to go into battle with stuffed dummies riding their spare horses to addle the wits of their enemies. But Macedonians were too sharp to fall for such ruses, and meanwhile Alexander himself had allowed so few fires to be lit that the Mongols would seriously underestimate the strength of those opposing them, as well as never guessing at the Macedonians' indomitable valor and will. Even Abdikadir felt his spirit rise as the king passed. Alexander was a remarkable man, he thought, if, like Genghis Khan, a terrible one. With his Kalashnikov at his side, curled up under his poncho and a coarse British blanket, Abdikadir tried to sleep. He felt oddly at peace. This confrontation with the Mongols seemed to have focused his own determination. It was one thing to know of the Mongols in the abstract, as a page of long dust history, and another to see their destructive ferocity in the flesh. The Mongols had done huge damage to Islam. They had come to the rich Islamic state of Khwarizm, a very ancient nation, stable and centralized since the mid-7th century B.C. In fact, Alexander the Great, on his cross-Eurasian jaunt, had come into contact with it. The Mongols sacked its beautiful cities of Afghanistan and northern Persia, from Herat to Kandahar and Samarkand. Like Babylonia, Khwarizm had been built on an elaborate underground irrigation system that had survived since antiquity. The Mongols destroyed this too, and with it, Khwarizm. Some Arab historians claim the region's economy had never recovered, and so on. The soul of Islam had been forever darkened by these events. Abdi Qadir had never been a zealot, but now he discovered in himself a passion to put history right. This time, Islam would be saved from the Mongol catastrophe and be reborn. But this wretched war had to be won first, at any cost. It was comforting, he thought, in the confusion left by the discontinuity, to have something to do, a goal of unambiguous value to aim at. Or maybe he was just rediscovering his own Macedonian blood. He wondered what Casey would say to all this. Casey, the jock Christian, born in Iowa in 2004, now caught between armies of Mongols and Macedonians in a time that had no date. "A good Christian soldier," Abdi Qadir murmured, "is only ever a click away from heaven." He smiled to himself. Kolya had lain in his hole in the ground under Genghis's yurt for 3 days. 3 days, blind and deaf and in agonizing pain. And yet, he lived. He could even sense the passage of time by the vibration of the feet and the floorboards above him, footsteps coming and going like a tide. If the Mongols had searched him, they would have found the plastic bag of water under his vest, the sips of which had kept him alive so long, and the one other item that this great gamble had been all about. But they had not searched him. A gamble, yes, and it had paid off, at least so far. He had known far more about the Mongols than Sable ever could, for he had grown up with their memory, 8 centuries old, yet still potent. And he had heard of Genghis's habit of sealing enemy princes under the floor of his yurt. So Kolya had leaked what information he could to Casey, knowing he would be caught. And once caught, he had let the treacherous Sable manipulate the Mongols into granting him this merciful release. All he had wanted was to be here in the dark, still alive, holding the device he had made, just a meter or so from Genghis Khan. The Soyuz had not carried any grenades, which would have been ideal, but they were unused explosive bolts. The Mongols would not have recognized what he had brought out of the spacecraft, even had they been watching him carefully. Sable would have known, of course, but in her arrogance, she had assumed Kolya was an irrelevance, not capable of hindering her own ambitions. Disregarded, it had been a simple matter for Kolya to rig up a simple trigger and to conceal his improvised weapon. He had to wait for the right time to strike. That was why he had to wait, in the dark and the agony. 3 days. It was like surviving 3 days beyond his own death. But how odd that his body kept functioning, that he had to urinate and even defecate, as if the body thought his story had an epilogue. But these were like the twitches of a fresh corpse, he thought, of a mannequin, meaningless in themselves. 3 days. But Russians were patient. They had a saying that the first 500 years are always the worst. First light gathered. The Macedonians started to move around, coughing, rubbing their eyes, urinating. Abdi Qadir sat up. The pink gray of the brightening sky was oddly beautiful. Scattered sunlight against volcano ash clouds, like cherry blossoms scattered on pumice. But he had only moments of peace after waking. First and last light are the most dangerous times for a soldier, when the eye struggles to adjust to fast-changing light. And in that moment of maximum vulnerability, the Mongols struck. They had approached the Macedonian positions in silence. Now the great Nakara called out, their camel-borne war drums, and the Mongols surged forward, screaming wildly. The sudden eruption of noise was blood-curdling, as if some immense force of nature was approaching, a flood or a landslide. But the Macedonians' trumpet peals followed only a heartbeat later. Soldiers rushed to their positions. There were brisk commands in the Macedonians' harsh dialect. Form up! Hold your position! Hold the line! The Macedonian infantry, 8 deep, made a wall of hardened leather and iron. Alexander had, of course, been prepared. Anticipating this assault, he had let his foe approach as close as he dared. Now was the time to spring his trap. Abdi Kadir took his place three ranks back from the front. To either side were nervous Tommies. Catching their glances, Abdi Kadir forced a smile and raised his Kalashnikov. He got his first good look at a Mongol warrior through a gun sight. The Mongols' heavy cavalry was at the center of the charge, with the light cavalry following behind. They wore body armor made of strips of buffalo leather, and metal helmets with leather guards over their necks and ears. Each man was loaded with weapons: two bows, three quivers, a lance with a vicious-looking hook on the end, an axe, a curved saber. Even the horses were armored, with broad leather sheets that guarded their sides and metal caps on their heads. The Mongols' carapace, bristling with weapons, looked more insectile than human. But they weren't having it all their own way. At a trumpet peal, archers popped up over the parapets of the walls of Babylon, and arrows hissed through the air over Abdi Kadir's head, thudding into the advancing Mongols. When a rider fell, there would be a tangle, briefly disrupting the charge. Now more arrows fell, ablaze, their tips dipped in pitch. They were aimed at flame pits, bales of hay soaked in pitch in the ground. Soon great pockets of flame and smoke were bursting up beneath the Mongols. Men screamed and their horses shied and refused. But though the grit of casualties slowed the Mongol advance, it did not halt it. And once again the Mongol heavy cavalry slammed into the Macedonians. All along the line the Macedonians fell back. The momentum of the Mongols' charge and the sheer ferocity with which the horsemen wielded their swords and maces made that inevitable. Abdi Kadir, now only a meter or so from the worst of the fighting, saw rearing horses, flat Mongol faces looming above the struggling crowd, men fighting and dying. He could smell blood, dust, the sweat of terrified horses, and even now a rank, buttery stink that could only be the Mongols themselves. The sheer density of men and animals, the roar of 10,000 voices, made it difficult to fight, even to raise a weapon. As blades hissed in the air, blood and body parts flew in scenes of almost absurd, impossible carnage, and gradually the screams of rage turned to howls of pain. More pressure came when the Mongol light cavalry followed up their heavy counterparts, pressing forward where the heavy cavalry had made room, jabbing with their swords and javelins. But Alexander struck back. Brave infantrymen rushed from the back of the Macedonian line carrying long, hooked lances. If the lance missed, the hook could dismount a warrior. Mongols fell, but the Macedonian infantrymen were cut down like flowers before a scythe. Now, through the clamor, a Macedonian trumpet sounded a clear peal. At the center of the field, just before Abdi Kadir, the surviving Macedonian front ranks pulled back, melting through the ranks behind them, leaving their wounded and dead. Suddenly there was nothing left, nothing between Abdi Kadir and the most ferocious horseback warriors who had ever lived. The Mongols, startled, their horses shying, hesitated for a second. One immense man, short but wide like a bear, stared into Abdi Kadir's eyes and raised a stubby mace that was already dripping with blood. Captain Grove was at Abdi Kadir's side. "Fire at will!" Abdi Kadir raised his Kalashnikov and pulled the trigger. The Mongol's head exploded into a mist of blood and bone, his metal cap hurled absurdly into the air. His horse bolted, the headless body sliding from the saddle into the pressing crowd. All around Abdi Kadir, the British fired into the mass of Mongols, antique British Martini Henrys and Snyders making precise coughs against the clatter of the Kalashnikovs. Men and horses disintegrated before the withering hail of bullets. Grenades flew. Most of them were just flashbangs, but that was enough to terrify the horses and at least some of the warriors. But one exploded under a horse. The animal seemed to burst, and its rider, screaming, was hurled away. One grenade landed too close to Abdi Kadir. The blast was like a punch to the stomach. He fell backward, his ears ringing, his nose and mouth filled with the sour metal taste of blood and the chemical tang of the ignition. He felt somehow dislocated, as if he had been knocked through another discontinuity. But if he was down, a corner of his mind told him there was a hole in the line before him. He raised his rifle, fired without looking, and struggled to his feet. The order came to advance. The line of British strode forward, firing continually. Abdi Kadir moved ahead with them, snapping a new magazine into his weapon as he did so. There was no open ground. He had to climb over earth littered by corpses and body parts, in places slippery with entrails. He even had to step onto the back of a wounded man who screamed in agony, but there was no other way. He was working, he thought at first. To left and right, as far as he could see, where they were not dying in their saddles, the Mongols were falling back, their weapons unable to match the firearms of 600 years and more after their time. But now Abdelkadir heard a high-pitched voice, a woman's voice, and some of the Mongols clambered off their horses. They actually advanced toward the gunfire, using the bodies of their comrades and their horses as cover. Abdelkadir recognized the tactics. Scan for threats, move, take cover, scan again. They were using their bows, the only weapon they had that could match the gun's range, and took turns to cover each other as they made their way forward, a maneuver called pepper-potting. And as they fired, Macedonian screams and a torrent of fluent Geordie oaths told Abdelkadir that some arrows were striking home. These Mongols had been trained to withstand gunfire, he realized. Sable. It had to be, just as they had feared. His heart sank. He snapped in another magazine and fired again. But the Mongols were closing. Abdelkadir and the other riflemen had been assigned a shield-bearer each, but these were being brushed aside. One horseback rider almost got through to Abdi, and he had to swing the rifle using the butt as a club. He got a lucky hit on the man's temple, and the Mongol reeled back. Before he could recover, Abdelkadir had shot him dead and was looking for the next target. From his elevated position on the Ishtar Gate, Josh could see the great sweep of the battle. Its bloody core was still the slab of struggling men and animals directly before the gate, where the Mongol heavy cavalry had collided with Alexander's foot companions. The eyes were everywhere, like floating pearls above the heads of the struggling warriors. The heavy cavalry was the Mongols' most powerful instrument, designed to smash the enemy's strongest forces in a single blow. It had been hoped that a sudden assault with gunfire would do enough damage to the heavy cavalry to blunt that blow. But for whatever reason, the Mongols had not fallen back, as had been hoped, and the armed troops were getting bogged down. This was bad news. There had only been 300 British troops in Jamrud, after all. Their numbers were no match for the Mongols, and even if every single bullet took a Mongol life, Genghis's troops would surely overwhelm them at last through sheer numbers. And now the Mongols threw more cavalry around the wings of the battlefield to envelop the enemy. This was again expected. It was a classic Mongol maneuver called the Tulugma. But its sheer ferocity as the new units smashed into the Macedonians' flanks was staggering. But Alexander wasn't done yet. Trumpets pealed out again from the city walls. With a great clang, gates were thrown open and the Macedonian cavalry at last rode out into the field. Even as they emerged, they were in their tight wedge formation. At a glance, Josh could see how much more skillful these horsemen of ancient times were than the Mongols. And at the head of the companions who rode out from the right-hand side, Josh recognized the bright purple cloak and white-plumed helmet of Alexander himself, a panther skin thrown over his saddle-cloth, as ever leading his men to glory or death. The Macedonians, fast, agile, and tightly disciplined, wheeled to cut into the Mongol flank like a scalpel. The Mongols tried to turn, but compressed now between the stolid Macedonian infantry and the companions, their movements were constricted, and the Macedonians began to jab at their unprotected faces with their long wooden spears. It was another classic tactic, Josh knew, a battle formation perfected by Alexander the Great, yet inherited from his father before him, with cavalry on the right delivering the killer blow, and the central infantry following up with its dogged pressure. Josh was no advocate of war, but he saw a kind of elation in the eyes of warriors on both sides as they hurled themselves into the fray, a kind of release that the moment in which all inhibitions could be shed was here at last, and a sort of joy. Josh felt a deep, visceral thrill as he watched this ancient, brilliant maneuver unfold before his eyes. Even as men fought and died in the dirt below, each one a unique life snuffed out. This is why we fight wars, we humans, he thought. This is why we play this game with the highest of stakes. Not for profit or power or territory, but for this intense pleasure. Kipling is right. War is fun. It is the dark secret of our kind. Perhaps that was why the eyes were here, to enjoy the unique spectacle of the universe's most vicious creatures dying in the dirt. Josh felt resentment and a certain squalid pride.